The views, opinions, and content of the show hosts and their guests appearing on America's Web Radio are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of the station.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
Good morning. This is Ori Hample, and I'm hailing from Houston, Texas. And Dr. Hal Schurz asked me to sit in for him for the show this morning because he has a prior engagement. And I'm glad to be back on the show. I want to take care of some business. And the business is that I'm so excited that because a week from now, we at Docs for Patient Care Foundation, we're going to be putting on our annual premier direct primary care conference, which will happen in Orlando this year. And this this conference is amazing, and it is the subtitle of it is The Happiest CME on Earth. And the it sounds very silly, and it sounds like we're making fun of Disney, but it's really, really true. All of us have gone to continuing medical education conferences, and it's a good way to catch up on sleep because the lectures are boring. We're doing it because we want to try to learn something. We have to meet continuing medical education requirements. But this conference is different. This conference is truly life-changing for many people. And I'm a specialist. I'm a urologist in Houston, Texas. And direct primary care, why would I be excited about direct primary care? Why? Because it is a way that gives physicians a new lease on life, a new career, a new lease on their career. It reinvigorates them on their mission of being a doctor and taking care of patients. It literally has proven life-saving, where we talk about physician burnout and physician depression and the struggles physicians are having in maintaining a practice or in just going to work. And this method of connecting patients and doctors and bringing back the physician-patient relationship to the true core of what that relationship should be literally has saved physicians from committing suicide and reinvigorated their lives and their careers. And you see this kind of energy. You see this kind of positive energy in our direct primary care conference. It is not too late. You can find your way over to Orlando. We have reception starting Thursday evening on March 14th, and the conference is really the meat of the conference is on Friday the 15th of March and Saturday the 16th of March, and it is truly an amazing way to get a whole lot of CME, continuing medical education. We thank the Florida Medical Association for helping us with that. And also a great way to actually find a way to get back to being a real doctor with a real physician-patient relationship without all the 800-pound gorillas in the room, specifically the third-party payer system and the government, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, so come join us. We'll find a way to sneak you in there, and we'll make room. It is we've had excellent pre-sold attendance to this conference, but we're on a mission, so if you find your way there, we'll find a way to fit you in there. Anyway, so welcome to the Doctor's Lounge. So as you know, the Doctor's Lounge is probably the worst possible place for any physician to be in a hospital. Why? It's a negative place. It's a place where physicians go and they complain about other physicians, about their patients, about their cases, about administration, about politics, about the government, about the third-party payers. It's a place where we complain. It's also a place where there's junk food. And all the things we tell our patients not to eat, that is what's available in the doctor's lounge. From soft drinks, which, depending on which part of country you're in, it's either soda, or where I grew up in Cleveland, it was called Pop, or where I'm in Texas now, it's called Coke. And the Coke of choice in Texas, of course, is Dr. Pepper. But But anyway, so all that stuff's in the doctor's lounge. So the doctor's lounge is a very negative place. But in this case, we're in the doctor's lounge here in a positive place. First, we talked about this, the happiest CME on earth, and that is a positive thing. And I've been looking forward for this since the last one over a year ago, and because it invigorates me. I'm not a direct primary care doctor, but to see doctors so happy about being doctors and learning about the possibilities of how we can take care of our patients better, it is so invigorating. I mean, this is why, I mean, I did 14 years of education and training past high school so that I can practice medicine and do my specialty and take care of patients. And you know, you get into the rut of the job, of what we do on a day-to-day basis. And doing peer-to-peers with other physicians who are not taking care of patients to get authority and authorization to order tests and do procedures that we know and they know our patients need. And those things frustrate us on a day-to-day basis. But this kind of a conference brings us to a new level of energy and new level of positivity. So that's the commercial part. And now let's get to the topic of the show. So I wanted to talk about patient advocacy. This is something that Dr. Helschers has talked about before on this show several times. But I want to talk about it from a completely different angle. So a couple of years ago, a few years ago, a patient, complicated patient, came to my office. He had a voiding dysfunction, and he came to me to see if we can fix his urination, his non-obstructive urinary retention, with neuromodulation, with sacral nerve stimulation. This is one of the things I do in my practice. And that wasn't what was so unique about the patient. What was so unique about the patient was in his insurance. He had Medicare and a Medigap. You know, obviously not the best paying of patients, but, you know, nice guy, smart guy. But he wanted to make sure that he really understood his health care. So what he did was he paid extra outside of the healthcare economy for a physician, an excellent physician, a physician who was trained at Tulane Medical School. That's where he did his residency and survived Katrina and has horror stories from that. And his name is Vic Rajan. And one of the things he does, he wears many hats, from doing emergency room work to doing concierge medicine to working on financial markets. But one of the things that he does, one of the hats that he wears, is he does patient advocacy. So patients pay him outside the healthcare economy, the direct care economy. Patients pay him, and what he does is he helps them navigate their healthcare. He comes with them to their doctor appointments. He goes with them to their tests. He reviews their charts. He reviews their labs. He communicates with their physicians as like a family member would. And he helps the patient understand what is happening with their health care and helps provide the patient the tools to make medical decisions for themselves. So, you know, some physicians, not any of us listening to the show, of course, but some physicians are very paternalistic. The patient comes to their office, they make a recommendation, they say, this is what you need to do, and you need to, this is what your diagnosis is, this is what I recommend you do, you better do this, or, you know, you can go somewhere else. And that's not how I work, that's not how many physicians work, that's not how we're trained. You know, doctor means teacher. What our role is to figure out or try to figure out what's going on with the patient and then explain that, teach that to the patient so that the patient can make educated decisions about their care. So this is an area of medicine that's basically untouched and untapped, because what happens is in today's medical economy and with the medical technology and with electronic medical records, patients come to their physician's offices. And they see the back of their physician as the physician is typing in the electronic medical record, EMR in the old days, EHR in today's days, and they document and they diagnose, and there's very little time for the patient to actually understand what's going on to be able to make a truly informed decision about what they should do about their care. And this is where patient advocacy comes in. So this is one business model of it. But that's not, and that was my first, real exposure to somebody who's a patient advocate, who's not the patient directly, who's a patient advocate on a very high level. Yes, we have patients who have wonderful families, and their families come with them. Some cultures of some of the patients that I treat, they literally come with the whole family, and they support the patient, and they take care of the patient, and it's wonderful to see. And some patients have various healthcare workers in their family, and they're much more involved in the care, and they can help explain to the patient what the doctor just told them, and that's awesome. But I'm going to tell you about my direct experience with this. So this is a completely different angle. So 30 years ago this year, I met my wife, the love of my life, Daniela. And it was a three-city setup. We both were here in Houston. I was here for residency at Baylor College of Medicine in the Texas Medical Center, and I lived close to just east of what was called the Astrodome then. And Daniela was in law school, and she lived in the same area. We never crossed paths until we got set up, my three-city setup. And we fell in love. We got engaged within 8 months. We got married 8 months after that. I finished my residency. We started our lives together. I went into practice. She helped me open my practice. She helped me put up my shingle and go into solo medical practice at the time, prove it's still America and you can go into business for yourself. 3 years later, she helped me bring on my partner. We've been over 22 years together. We have a huge, very successful practice. Extremely fortunate. Daniela's, is the mother of our four children. We had a very fortunate life. And a little over 4 years ago, in November of 2019, due to family members being diagnosed with breast cancer, Daniela aggressively pursued investigating her disease, and she was diagnosed as having breast cancer. In December, 4 years ago, she underwent a large operation, an 8.5-hour surgery in the Texas Medical Center, modified mastectomy with a deep flap reconstruction, just an amazing surgical result. She had unbelievable surgeons. And during this process, from the time of the diagnosis, the decision to do the biopsy, the decision to do another biopsy, the workup, the medical decision-making of what's the best path of treatment. Do we do lumpectomy and radiation? Do we do mastectomy and reconstruction? What type of reconstruction? All these things. Well, these were huge decisions. And this is where, and during that part, what Daniela was saying is that every family needs to have a doctor in it. Every family needs to have a doctor in order to navigate the system. Not just the system, but also the health information, just the data, to sort out the data and try to translate it into what that means to the patient themselves. We know that in other countries, when patients get hospitalized, the family has to come in and literally do the nursing for the patients, change their beds, bathe them, feed them, because that's not a nursing task. The nurses bring medications, and the family actually takes care of the patient. Well, I could tell you that when Daniela had her surgery and had her 3-day hospitalizations, I was literally, from the time she was in the post-anesthesia care unit in the recovery room after her 8.5-hour surgery, I never left her. I was in the hospital for 72 hours straight with her, and I never left her side. And I, like a hawk, I watched every medication being given. I made sure the nurses called the residents to renew expiring medications that, quote, fell off, unquote, and expired because they were expensive. They cost $17 a dose, like some of the pain medications. And IV Tylenol specifically, which is amazing, and it allows the patient to not require as much narcotics. But at $17 a dose, it's more expensive than morphine. So you kind of have to, you know, ride the residents in order to renew these automatically expiring medications. And literally, I was her patient advocate. I performed the role that Dr. Vic Rajan gets paid by some of his patients to play. And I did for my wife. And as one of our friends said, Daniela battled the cancer, and Ori battled the system. And it was true. And it was her disease. It was her diagnosis. It was her real battle, life and death battle. And the system was my battle. And I supported her in every way that I possibly could and could think of, and ways that I didn't even think of, but she thought of, or family members thought of. And what I learned through this whole process was that there's a different path if one has a physician advocate. And what happened was we had an excellent surgical result. We had negative margins and negative lymph nodes. Through all the esoteric testing that is done, specifically in Oncotype DX, her score translated into a recurrent disease chance of 8%, which meant that chemotherapy and adjuvant therapy wasn't recommended. The chances that the cancer was cured was 92%. And we basically were told just follow up every 6 months to check the contralateral side. And we're good, or so we thought. And 2 years later, at the latter part of 2021, Daniela had some pains, and that led to a diagnosis of bony metastatic breast cancer, and that led to a completely different path that neither of us ever wanted to think about and never wanted to face. But she had to battle that, and you know, I was her. I was riding shotgun, figuratively and literally sometimes. So, and this was to be on that side of the physician-patient relationship was an amazing, eye-opening experience. I don't want to say that it was a great experience or a pleasurable experience, but it was a huge eye-opening experience because I'm a urologist. I diagnose patients with cancer all the time, prostate cancer, bladder cancer, kidney cancer. I do big, major surgeries for cancer. I manage my patients. I follow them. After their treatment, I continue to follow them. I just don't pawn them off on an oncologist. I take care of my cancer patients from evaluation to diagnosis to management, surgical and medical management, and to follow-up. And you know, my patients, you know, thank God the vast majority of them in the upper 90s are cured from their cancer. They don't succumb to their cancerous disease. And we were told that bony metastatic breast cancer, we treat this like a chronic disease, like diabetes and hypertension. People live many years and very, you know, and live life to the fullest for many years with this kind of a diagnosis. They never said the word curable, but they said they definitely used the word manageable. And did we have second opinions? We had multiple opinions. So every time Daniela went to her oncologist, and she was being managed at Baylor College of Medicine in the Texas Medical Center. Wonderful oncology team, just very caring, very responsive, just amazing. But every time that there was a diagnosis, a study, whatever, I would, of course, call oncologists that I personally know in all corners of the country, literally, and run that by them. So whenever we had an opinion, I got at least 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 opinions. And we followed the guidelines. And Daniela tried additional things. She tried integrative medicine on top of the traditional medications. She did meditation. She tried all kinds of diets. Just pulled out all the stops. And she was healthy going into this diagnosis in this battle. Daniela always watched what she ate. She, of course, watched what I ate, too. that meant that I didn't eat as much Bluebell ice cream as I wanted to. And if you don't know what Bluebell ice cream is, you definitely need to come to Texas, at least for a visit, just for Bluebell, if for no other reason. She exercised. She was healthy, and which I'm sure contributed to some of her longevity. And we were put on a medication, and the initial medication was a CDK4/6 inhibitor. That medication didn't exist when I was in medical school, and so as we were introduced to medications, I studied them. I read the package insert. I read the literature. I did that, and then I would translate to Daniela what this means. What do we expect? Etc. But as an advocate for my wife, and more specifically as an advocate who knew how to negotiate the system, because the system, this first medication we were put on, it was on a regimen of 3 weeks on, 1 week off, and you don't pick that up at Walgreens or CVS or Walmart or Costco pharmacy. Amazon pharmacy can't deliver it to your house. This medication, a 3 week supply, are insurance paid. The specialty pharmacy is where you get cancer medications and injectable medications. It paid the specialty pharmacy $16,500 for a 3 week supply. Not retail price, that was what was paid. So when medications cost that much, there's an authorization process. There is a process where the physician has to send medical records, and the physician has to call and appeal. And so my role was that not just to learn about the medication. My role was to work with Daniela's oncologist and her wonderful nurse practitioner, Sarah, to fight, literally, it was a battle, to fight to get this medication authorized, to get this medication prescribed, to find a way to get a sample of the medicine, because to get the medicine prescribed took at least a month until we actually got it delivered to the home. So during that month, we had untreated metastatic disease. But we didn't, because I was able to find a way through my connections, through drug reps that helped me with expensive cancer medications for my patients, hooked up with drug reps for that, and then we had to negotiate to have a physician sign for the samples, and then so Daniela was able to start on that medication within a week, which meant that she got a jump on her cancer for over a month, because that medication didn't show up in her home through the normal channels for over a month. And this is where my advocacy in working alongside with my wife, Daniela, the patient, played a role. And you know what? That medication, getting a 1 month start on that medication, gave her that much longer to live, because that medication was the best medication of all the medicines she was on. And at 6 months from the diagnosis of bony metastatic disease, she had a PET scan that showed that all the bony lesions, ones we knew about and ones we found out about because of the reaction, they all responded to this first medicine wonderfully. And there were no lesions that were hot. And we were excited, reserved, but excited, because 6 months after this metastatic cancer diagnosis, which we thought was an immediate death sentence, we had a phenomenal response. And we were upbeat temporarily. And you know, we were going through life and enjoying life and going on hikes in Rocky Mountain National Park and enjoying our four children and enjoying family milestones and surviving COVID and surviving more COVID and surviving more COVID. And and 3 months later, in October of 2022, we had a PET scan that showed that that medicine was no longer working. And we had expensive, sophisticated PCR blood tests that showed that there were two estrogen receptor mutations. And this is where, again, my role as a physician advocate, as a patient as a physician advocate for patients, you know, help Daniela understand what this means, on the molecular level, what the fact that why this cancer is and these metastases are growing, because this estrogen receptor didn't care that there was no longer estrogen around. It was making the cancer grow. But patients don't know this. Patients that don't have medical training and high level of medical training can't really understand what's going on. They can't understand, because they're not expected to understand, you know, how this medicine works or doesn't work, and how these other medicines work or don't work, or how this cancer is able to now grow and threaten their lives. And now some patients are perfectly content putting a trust in their physician and going with whatever the physician recommends. And, you know, the physicians, most of us, I'm sure, go through our careers and our patient population and really try and really do believe that we're doing the best for them, that we're making the best recommendations to maintain their quality of life and their quantity of life. But some patients, educated patients especially, highly educated patients with multiple degrees, those patients a lot of times need data. They need, psychologically, they need to understand a lot more of what's going on a technical level, what's going on with the disease, and what are the various treatment choices. And that is where a physician advocate can help those patients understand what's going on. And so that was my role. And, of course, as we were going through this process, I had to get my own education, because all these medications that, or many of these medications that we encountered, they all were discovered or invented or designed or manufactured or engineered, you know, long after I went to medical school and I did my residency. Part of my general surgery training, preliminarily before urology, you know, I was doing breast biopsies. I was, you know, taking out lumps. I was helping doing mastectomies. And I knew some about breast cancer, but, I mean, that was in the early 1990s. That's light years away from the knowledge and the technology that we have today. That's what we did then does not follow the NCCN guidelines of today that guide what we do. And so here I was learning, but of course I'm a physician, so I have the tools to know how to learn and the tools to understand what is being talked about in the literature and the package inserts of these various medications. And so the first medicine was the best medicine. And then, so come October of 2022, not even a year and a half ago, we found out that the first medication that we were hoping would be working for 5 to 10 years was no longer working. And it wasn't one medication. She was a combination of three medication, an infusion, an estrogen blocker, and then the CDK4/6 inhibitor. And, you know, of course, these are all medicines that I, as a urologist, do not use and do not prescribe. And so I had to get my own education so that I can be a physician advocate and explain things to Daniela. And this is not why I went to medical school, but going to medical school helped me do this. And so then came the other battle. So I fought a battle in the beginning of, at the end of 2021, beginning of 2022, to get Daniela this medicine, this latest and greatest medication that's advertised on television, that worked great for about 6 months and stopped working after and had no effect 3 months later. And that was the first medication. And so then it was time to try something else. And here we were literally fighting her cancer with the latest and greatest medications and the latest and greatest indications. And so we found out from Daniela's oncologist, Dr. Osborne, told us that we've got a medicine that's been around for just a couple years, but a month ago we got a new indication for your type of disease, which is weak HER2 positive. Which is technically negative, but it's weakly positive, so now we have another indication, so we can do this targeted chemo. And so we suddenly I had to learn about what targeted chemo is. It's an antibody attached to a chemo molecule where it goes to the cells and then delivers a chemo molecule, and the cells take on that chemo molecule in a localized fashion. So it's systemic therapy that really doesn't go everywhere. That it only goes to where the cancer is, and then it's basically a guided chemo missile. And and we started with infusions every 3 weeks of this medication. And here we were at the cutting edge of the NCCN guidelines, and we started the second medication. And 3 months later, in the beginning of February of 2023, it seems forever ago. It's only a year ago. So in the beginning of February 2023, we got a PET scan that showed that medication, the latest and greatest, did nothing more than placebo at best, and all the tumors grew. And then we switched gears and had a brand new medication. So as Dr. Osborne was telling us the results of the PET scan, and this is another thing about being a physician advocate. So when one orders a PET scan, there's a whole authorization process. There's a whole scheduling process because PET scans, you need to have a radioactive glucose dose. And those doses are manufactured for each scan specifically. And so sometimes you can't get a PET scan. You can't get on the schedule for a PET scan for weeks or months or a month. And so here we have a failure of therapy, right? We don't have a failure of therapy exactly. We didn't know we had a failure of therapy, but we knew that we needed to have a change in therapy. Daniela started to have some aches and pains. It was managed with non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medications, a little over-the-counter ibuprofen and some Tylenol. So there were some, you know, some musculoskeletal pains. So Daniela knew, she absolutely knew when treatments weren't working. She knew when they weren't working because she felt it. She was very much in touch with her, in tune with her body, and she knew when the therapy wasn't working. We just needed the scans to prove it, because you can't change therapy without a scan. You can't get authorization for medication without a scan. So you need a scan. So that is where I put on my battle gear, and I would call in favors, facilities that I refer patients to, facilities that I help support with business from my practice. I would call on them and say, what can you do to get us a scan? What can we do to get it sooner? And you know what? I'm humbled by how people physicians and non-physicians and technologists and technicians and administrators would literally jump at my initial requests and help fight with me, the insurance companies, etc., to get Daniela scheduled. And so that several week to get a PET scan would be shortcut into a couple of days. And so we got that PET scan. And so whenever there's a change of therapy, in order to move quickly, in order to change therapies quickly, that's where I had to get into my advocacy. So if you don't have that physician advocate, and it, not just any physician, you've got to have a physician who understands how to negotiate the system, a physician who understands how the system works, a physician who understands all the different aspects of the economics of the delivery of care, the third-party payer system, the scheduling apparatuses, how the logistics work of actually getting the scan done, and what needs to happen in order to get the scan done, and not just the instructions of, not eating or drinking any, or not eating anything for 6 hours before a PET scan and things like that, just the logistics of how to get it organized and how to get it scheduled and how to make it happen. And so here I was getting that done, and so we got a PET scan in February a year ago, and it showed that we had treatment failure. And guess what? There was a medication, and we had a third estrogen receptor mutation, so there was a medication that was FDA approved 11 days prior to that PET scan that Daniela was the poster child for that medication. And it was newly FDA approved by a small drug company out of Italy. It was called Ilisestrant. And it was an estrogen receptor degrader, and it had a 40% response rate, and we were very hopeful. But it's a new medication. It's not on any formulary for any insurance company. It's not in the NCCN guidelines yet. And so here I was, calling, making hour-long phone calls every single day. Here was Daniela calling her, calling our insurance company, talking to these agents and saying, you understand, this cancer is growing. I'm talking to you, and as I'm talking to you, you're not authorizing this medicine. You are facilitating my death. Yes, this is what I heard her say to insurance companies. And and believe it or not, within 10 days of that PET scan, Daniela was probably the first patient in the country through the normal commercial channels, through specialty pharmacy, to get started an Ilisestrant within less than a month of it being FDA approved. And, and then through our channels, through our support system, through physicians that we know through our family, we helped organize a second opinion. And we flew to New York to Memorial Sloan Kettering and did a second opinion who reviewed all the data and basically reassured us that the people at Baylor College of Medicine were doing exactly what they would be doing with the exact medications, at the exact same dosing, at the exact same timing, and they've got nothing to add, that we're getting the absolute best care. Did it change the management? No, but it made gave us reassurance that we're doing the right things. We're doing the best that we can do because Daniela wanted to stay around for family milestones, for the future weddings, God willing, of our four children and future grandchildren, etc. So Daniela fought because she wanted to be there for that. And then I fought because I wanted her beside me for all those moments. And so that medication she was on for not even 2 months, for about 6 to 7 weeks, and then she had severe pains. And then she had severe pains in early April, and I got a PET scan organized the same day. The same day as the severe pain started, within 24 hours, Daniela had a PET scan. It is unheard of to get a PET scan within a day. But you know what? There were so many other physicians that supported us through my connections and through my relationships. People stepped up, I mean, in the absolute most amazing and most humbling way, to stepped up to battle, to help Daniela battle. We got a PET scan, and it was terrible. And after being on three of the latest and greatest medications, she started chemo from the 1960s and 70s. The worst chemos you can be on, adriamycin and cytoxin. Adriamycin is cardiotoxic, and it's nicknamed the Red Devil. And then Daniela started that battle. Mind you, you know, throughout this path, we also had to organize getting a port, an infusion port. And, physicians that stepped up to get that organized in a way that fit our schedule and our busy lives. And after 3 months of that medication, we had a 50% response. And even at this point, we had a few liver metastases. We had an excellent response, but we couldn't take any more of that medication. And I'm just going to fast forward to the end of last year. Her metastatic disease progressed, and it was absolutely awful and horrible. And right after Christmas on December 26th, she went into the hospital. This time she went into MD Anderson, and they did an amazing job of keeping Daniela comfortable, making her comfortable, and providing her dignity, and providing her as comfortable a possible way to pass away to the next world. And she passed away on January 4th. That's when I lost the love of my life. And I was at her bedside. Her sister was there. Her mother was there. We slept in the hospital. We had family members from all corners of the country come, and we were there, and we were able to have the funeral the same day, the same afternoon as the morning that she passed. I was at her bedside except for about 3 hours for 10 days straight as she was in the hospital. I didn't want her to pass away in the hospital, but she needed the pain control. She needed that. She couldn't go home to die. The staff at the hospital at MD Anderson were wonderful. We got some care there. Most of our care we got at Baylor College of Medicine. Daniela's nurse practitioner from Baylor came to visit her in the hospital, and her oncologist was calling on the phone and following her data on Epic, really just amazing care. And here I was in the hospital as a physician advocate, as a patient advocate, and because the nurses can't be at the bedside 100% of the time. But I could, and I did, and I was, and I could see when she had pains, I would go to the nurse and say, okay, we need a bolus of the morphine. I would be there to to help guide, help bring the nurses in whenever anything was needed, and be able to protect her from interventions, even interventions such as vital signs in the middle of the night, so that she wouldn't have to be woken up when she was resting. And she was basically, until the last night of her life, she was cracking jokes and being her positive, happy, uplifting, wonderful person that she was, that I fell in love with. And as our marriage progressed over next week, on Saturday would have been our 28th wedding anniversary, and as our lives progressed, we never grew apart. We actually grew together. We grew closer together. Our love was strengthened with time, and you know, this whole experience, it was a horrible experience, and it was incredibly eye-opening as a physician, because here I am, I tell patients they have cancer all the time. You know, every time I see a path report, not just in the last 4 years, but for the last 25 and a half years in practice, and even when I was a resident, for the last, you know, 30-something years, every time I see a pathology report that says it's a positive biopsy, I do the head nod, the head drop, which is a signal in the operating room that I'm frustrated. I do the head drop, and I'm like, oh, not another cancer. And then I got to tell a patient they got cancer, and it means that, you know, now I got to coach them through teaching them about their disease and helping them make the best treatment and management options. And you know, I was always very aware of this and always trying to support my patients the best way I know. But now that I've experienced it from the other side, from the patient side, it is a completely different perspective and a completely different experience. And it reassured me that what I've been doing in supporting my patients and what my staff has been doing all these years, my wonderful office staff, as far as helping patients get their medications authorized and help getting them patient assistance, because some of these medications are crazy expensive. When I say expensive, I'm talking, you know, some of the cancer medicines I prescribe cost $14,000 a month for pills, just like Daniela's medications. The third treatment she was on, one pill a day, a 30-day supply, costs $26,500. That's what the insurance paid the specialty pharmacy. But being that physician advocate, the physician who's a patient advocate, in about a 14-month time frame, Daniela went through, after her first therapy, and so her first systemic therapy lasted about 9 months, and then the following 14 months, she went on seven different systemic therapies. Seven systemic therapies. So in a period of less than 2 years, Daniela went through eight different therapies. And if one realizes that it takes about each therapy around 2 to 3 months to see if it works, and then you got to have radiology, and then you have to have authorization, and to start another therapy, and, you know, besides doctor's visits, and, you know, the doctors were, you know, Daniela's healthcare team was amazing about bringing her in and being available for her and bending over backwards to accommodate and to help and to get her started on the next therapies, but here I was battling to get tests done and to get medications authorized and to get treatments authorized. And to be able to be on that many therapies in that short period of time is absolutely unheard of. It's incredible. And, you know, as my friend said, Daniela was battling the cancer and Ori was battling the system. And, yes, we battled and we lost the war. But I would like to believe that through our battles, we had Daniela maybe 6 months longer than we would have otherwise, maybe 8 months longer than we otherwise would have. She was functional a week before she went into the hospital. You know, she only was hospitalized one time, and that was in order to pass away. She was hospitalized after her big surgery for over 4 years ago, and the only other time she was ever hospitalized, she had two ER visits for IV hydration. But other than that, this was only the second hospitalization of this disease, and which was her final one. So she maintained about a week, literally a week before she went in to the hospital for the last time. She took our fourth child to have a doctor's appointment because she was still mom. She was hardly eating anything, and she was still functioning. She was still a wife, you know, working on improving me, a very, very formidable task. Definitely an uphill battle. But working on me, being a supportive wife, being making me better person, better father, better husband, taking care of the kids. And we were able to do this, not just because of the special person she was, but also because of how I was able to help her do her battle. And,
About 2 minutes.
Okay. So I'm going to wrap up this show. And, thank you for letting me share this story. And explain the whole concept of being a physician who can advocate for a patient and that whole concept and how I'd like to think we can make the patient's experience. In this case, it was a negative result in the end because Daniela died, and I lost the love of my life. But I'd like to think that we live life to the fullest for those 4 years since the cancer diagnosis. And one last reminder, Direct Primary Care Conference in Orlando. Go to D4PC. Foundation.org, Docs for Patient Care Foundation, D4PCFoundation.org. Look for the Direct Primary Care Conference, the happiest See Me on Earth. We hope to see you in Orlando. It was definitely not your typical continuing medical education conference. You can get more than a dozen CME in a couple of days. That conference has proven life-changing to countless physicians, and with consequently life-changing for thousands of patients. So it is highly recommended, and we would love to see you there. And let us all find ways to be better advocates for our patients. And our families as they deal with their health care, but for our patients too, because this is why we're here. This is why we gave up our 20s. We gave up our 20s so we can be doctors. We didn't do this because of the big pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. We could have run hedge funds or become lawyers or do something else that we're all talented people that went to medical school and who are hardworking and motivated and smart. But we chose to take care of our patients. We chose to be physicians. And we competed for this privilege. And it is a privilege. And so we need to embrace it, and we need to remember that we need to be advocates for our patients and our families.
The views, opinions, and content of the show hosts and their guests appearing on America's Web Radio are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of the station.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.